descesse.
Don't you remember? Thunder. Fire. Death.
I remember. A wife. A son. Home.
Ithaca's a kingdom waiting for a king.
My dad is coming home.
You're pining for a daddy you didn't even know. Like some sniveling bastard.
Ithaca's king is coming back.
Bringing vengeance.
If he returned, he'd have to kill him, like you will.
You gods don't speak in ways we understand.
Who doesn't understand pain? Or blood? The gods told you.
Then I defy the gods.
Welcome to the Shelf Shedding Movie Show. I am your host, Jason Dubray. We're doing something different with this episode. We're talking about the biggest movie in the world. We're only talking about one movie in this episode, which I never do. And normally it's six movies, or I have a few movies against each other, or we do a list or something. Talking about The Odyssey, a few different reasons I want to talk about Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey. One is just the chance to have Skye Brandon and Tim Hildebrandt together to talk about this. Tim, very recently, it feels like I just talked to you in podcast time, but it was actually months ago in the recording time. But we did the Ben Affleck and Matt Damon kind of a rank show of their work. And then we were, of course, talking about The Odyssey's coming out in a few months at that time. And then a while ago, Skye and I did a Christopher Nolan episode where we reviewed six Christopher Nolan movies. It wasn't like his total filmography we were talking about in that episode. So also just the chance, you two are just insanely busy people, and just I appreciate your time coming on to chat about this. The other reason is it feels like when this movie came out, the earth stopped, and suddenly the hyperbole and the reviews and the talk around it, even now we're into the second weekend, is enormous, where the Academy Awards are over. It's pretty much won 14 Academy Awards, and that's over. This is the greatest movie of all time, definitely Christopher Nolan's greatest movie of all time. And I think we can all agree this isn't a movie that I would shed from my collection if it was available. I'm guessing there'll be like six thumbs up for this movie, so that won't be the question mark. But the question for us is, do people need to give this time, take a breath, see what it's, you know, like in a few years? I mean, we'll be talking about how we feel about it now, but is all the hype, is it earned, or is this just we're living in this nostalgic feeling about this? I don't normally bring in other people's stuff here. I do have a little bit of a article that came across my Facebook today from Variety, which had put a little bit of shade towards Christopher Nolan today. So already I feel like as there are with these big movies that are successful, the backlash comes, and we have 6 months or more of backlash for a film that is this big. But all that to say, I think we'll be agreeing on this as an amazing achievement. But, and we'll be taking kind of a poll of today with the right to change our minds in the future of where we think it ranks in the filmography of Christopher Nolan. So anyway, nice. Gentlemen, that's what we're doing with this one here. I just want to welcome you back. Thanks for coming on the show.
For sure.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's an excuse to visit with friends that I don't usually get to chat with all that often, so why not?
Yeah. And so, Tim, last time we talked, you were traveling around with that show, and you were all over the U.S., and you're all in the province of Saskatchewan right now. And so, So it's good to have you home.
Thanks. Nice to be around. It's nice to be home.
Yeah. Yeah, it probably feels different after a number of years. Just
it doesn't. The prices are higher. That's the only thing I notice is that the prices of everything are so much higher than when I left 10 years ago.
Yes, they're higher since last weekend when I travel the lake a lot. I go through Rostern or whatever, and I'm like looking at the gas prices and comparing. Well,
I'm spending most of my time in a very rural part of Saskatchewan, and so not. Things change, but at a much slower pace here, and so there's a lot of familiar things here. So it doesn't feel like too much time has passed.
And Sky, since we last talked, I don't know that. Yeah, when we talked the Nolan show, you weren't at that point. You know, the artistic director, artistic producer at Shakespeare in the Saskatchewan, but we got you in the middle of. I mean, the shows are. They're just starting here, so
they just opened.
I appreciate this is your day off, sort of. You described to me before what your day off was like, which is not really a day off. But thank you for carving out some time to talk about this.
No, I don't often go to the movie theater. Well, I don't go as frequently as I used to. Right, I used to go all the time. It was like the thing that Christine and I, my wife, we would just go do. Like, hey, we got time and. And then we'd have family events. We would go, whether it was Marvel and or a Star Wars or something like that. But since COVID, I really don't. And it's not like a conscious choice, but I just do not go as often. But this one for Odyssey, it just lined up. It's like, you know what? We just opened Julius Caesar. We did a 5 p.m. showtime on a Sunday. So everything was kind of wrapped up by 9. And I just kind of said, screw it. I'm just going to go watch the movie.
You had the energy for the 3-hour epic.
But I had friends who were going into Regina the next day to actually see it in the IMAX theater. So we were talking about it. So that's why I was on my mind. I'm like, I'm just going to treat myself. I'm just going to go. And I enjoyed it enough where I said to Christy, I'm like, yeah, you really should see it. And then we went back the next night. So I watched it back-to-back days. Not in IMAX, but in the AVX. So I'm happy to talk movies and Nolan and Odyssey with you guys.
And you watching it twice in 2 days, I'll probably be relying on you at some point, as far as, there'll be some things. Watching it once is interesting because then you might misremember things or some of those details too. What is your history with Homer's The Odyssey? Because I really did not study it. And I was reading it and trying to kind of in the months, we knew this was coming out a year or two before, we knew this was his next project, and I was trying to prepare for that. And of course, it's not the easiest thing. I think it's one of those things where you take a class or you get guided through a little bit. There are some pieces of the story that, we can kind of, figure out in our, but then there's some other details. And I mean, it's so related to the Iliad and all of that. So what was your history for both of you with, with this material that's, thousands of years old?
3,000 years.
3,000 years, not thousands.
For me, Mr. Dolo's grade 8 English class. It was a big deal.
Oh, nice.
He assigned it to us, and I might have been in the minority, but I ate it up with a big spoon. I just loved it. We did both. We both did. I can't remember, it's been a while now, but I remember him giving it out as a handout. So I don't know if it was a condensed or if it was some kind of like a select or if it was I remember just motoring through the whole thing. The Iliad and the Odyssey over that academic year he gave it to us. So that I loved it from day one, and it's part of the reason why I took like a classics class at university, because I just enjoyed the myths so much. I remember Rhoda Maico saying to me at one point during like my advisory, she said, "Why are you taking this class? Like, you don't need it. Like, you, it's not, I'm like, I'm gonna kill in this class. That's why. It's gonna bring my average up. That's why I'm taking this class." And I did. I got like a 91 or something in it.
That's awesome.
Great.
This is taking care of the fact that I'm not gonna do as good in some of the other ones. So that's
That
me.
a grade eight teacher did that. I mean,
Yeah,
I just love
that's
that there are
awesome.
teachers out there that are still pushing the classics and,
He might hate me for this scene. I don't know that he'll ever hear it, but Mr. Dole, the other thing he would do too, like at one point we realized I was the only student who was going to be in class that day because like of a band trip and I wasn't in band, and all of a sudden it's like, it's just going to be you, Brandon. I'm like, what the hell? So he took me to Dairy Queen. Like, he just, we're like, come on, we're leaving the school. And we just hopped in the car and drove to the Melford Dairy Queen and we sat and had a blizzard. I was
Great.
like, what are you doing? He's like, English class. So.
Well, that's what you
Genius.
do. Yeah.
That's
I have
genius.
a story about that one time when there was a thing called senior skip day, and I had one student show up for my class, and I rewarded that student because, what else you can do, so.
That's good. How about you, Tim?
I originally came to the U of S as an education student, or as an education hopeful, because the way the program is set up, you take 2 years of education classes in the second half of your 4-year degree. The first half of your degree is you take all the credits in the subjects you want to teach. So I wanted to be an English and a drama teacher, high school English and drama teacher. So I had to take all sorts of English and drama classes, and then you're supposed to switch into the education program and learn how to teach them in year 3 and 4. So I actually took a lot of English lit and classics early on, and I had, like everybody, you always hear these books. But that's where I was introduced to the Iliad and the Odyssey. It was in my first or second year English lit classes.
Cool.
And I don't remember, I think I was lazy and skimmed it for the test. I didn't eat it up the way Sky did. I wish I could say I did. I think I fall into that category of people who love this movie so much. Spoiler alert, I loved it. Because it makes you feel smarter. Because you're like, oh, this famous academic piece of work that really smart people like and talk about, I actually like it. And I think that's one of the reasons so many people are loving this movie, is they're like, oh, this thing that I always assumed was not going to be accessible to me, or this thing that I always assumed was going to be too over my head, or oh, it's actually really cool. I loved it. I love the story. I love the characters. It's So I think I probably fall more into that category of viewership.
I'll do a little bit of a plot. I mean, this is like, this is an old story, and but it's, and I wasn't sure originally how Nolan was going to do it, and if he was going to do like free verse or, but well, I think we will agree he makes it very accessible, but he still kind of keeps it's an intelligent movie, and he does his deconstruction thing, which he does with nearly every film, where you are like looking at, you're in the present, but you're looking at flashbacks and flashbacks within flashbacks. And I mean, everything has that kind of a Memento or Inception type of an idea. And somehow he gets the end of it and wraps it all up so beautifully, but he's doing that with Homer's material. So I'm going to read a quote about that in a second. But Matt Damon is playing Odysseus. I originally thought that was unusual casting, but we could talk about that when we get a little bit more into the review. And it is a 20-year odyssey to get home after he's fought in the Trojan War. And then we have start off in the very first scene in this telling of it with the Trojan horse and the trap that was laid out, which was kind of the climax of that particular war, and then we move away from it and we come back to it. And so and that's what Christopher Nolan likes to do. And there are apparently some people that are taking issue with it. So it this for what it I didn't go into deep academic research. This was just something that came up on Facebook today, that again, I think it was Variety is running with it, because everything Odyssey is probably selling with the Variety articles right now online, but the Odyssey translator Emily Wilson slams Christopher Nolan's movie over abysmal writing. "I would be ashamed to have written any part of this script," is the headline.
Wow.
Nolan's Odyssey lacks many of the elements that make the poem great. It has nothing convincing to say about time, memory, history, war, or about the relationship between one's warrior's glorious return and the lives of his family, adversaries, comrades, friends, and neighbors. It lacks psychological, emotional, political, and ethical depth. Its narrative structure is gimmicky. The writing is abysmal. None of the characters has convincing motivation for their actions or words. There are no sex scenes, and all the food looks horrible. Via the London Review of Books / The Guardian, that is where Emily Wilson stands on the screenplay to the Odyssey. My thought was, I mean, maybe that, like, his movies are so much about what he does visually. I think Memento, which was kind of his big break, it wasn't his first film, because he did that backward structure, the screenplay became a bit the star of the film. And over the years, as he's evolved as a filmmaker, you know, his visuals and his directing and everything that he can do has been, and also his commitment to film and IMAX and where he stands on his philosophy of cinema, that's become the star of his films. The last few times, I haven't thought the screenplay was always the reason to see his films, which is often, you know, screenplay is pretty important to me. But I thought he did a quite a good job of, as I said before, making the Odyssey accessible for, you know, the summer movie viewer, and people are going to this and it's making a lot of money, and making it relatable, but also making it challenging. It isn't something where you can, you know, you can't be into your phone, you can't be talking to your friends, like, you have to be paying attention to this film, much like Oppenheimer before it. And so I don't think I agree with this particular analysis of the screenplay. But I do get the sense that anytime you're going to adapt a classic work like this, there will be academics and people coming out of the woodwork to have some complaints. If, you know, Sky, if, like, you know, you're doing Shakespeare all the time, I'll never forget, like, Henry Wolfe's Much Ado About Nothing with the bumblebees. And people really, like, you know, the purists talk to him at other university professors saying, why were you doing this? And, like, he had different reasons for it. So I don't know if that's some of where the backlash on this film will start to come. And does that even matter? I don't think it's going to matter to, like, the majority of moviegoers, but that was just something. I haven't seen something that scathing directed towards that film yet to this point. There were some kind of mixed reviews, but most of the reviews have been pretty good.
Yeah, he's been quite positive about her adaptation and how that's one that he's relied on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if it's more about her take on what he adapted or was inspired to do based on hers, and she just had a different outlook altogether. Some of the stuff that I've heard most of, even just kind of conversationally with friends through chat, you know, some people are like, oh, I just find it odd that they say things like dad, and, like, you know, instead of saying something like father, like that it like, not that they're wanting people to walk around with British accents or anything like that, because that would be ridiculous in a whole other sense. It's like, well, okay, what are we trying to do here? If you're trying to make it feel classical, but it's an old Greek story, a Greek myth, and you got British accents, that's not helping either. So it never took me out, but I can understand where, like, oh, to my ear, that felt too quote-unquote relaxed. But that's a taste thing. I don't think, like, I thought there was plenty of commentary about war and the effects of war, and I did actually find it emotionally invested and found it rewarding, especially by the end. We'll talk about more of that. Like, I wasn't, like, blown out of my seat the whole time. I was like, I'm enjoying this. Yeah, this is good. And I think I was taking more in the technical spectacle in terms of how it was being put together. And, like, I wonder how the heck did they do that was on my mind a lot as I watched
it. Practical too, for the most part. It's practical.
Yeah, exactly. And then, and knowing that, that's why I knew, I'm like, I know this isn't CGI, or it's not primarily CGI, you know, in terms of Cyclops, being a puppet, and it's Bill Irwin, and they're doing like cross editing things that they would have done. But by the end, I'm like, oh, I see what he did. Very, very clever. Like, I really found the ending a payoff in terms of that final scene between Odysseus and Penelope, and the guilt, and whether he is able to articulate it at the moment, although it seems he does, but that when he realizes they are the people from the sea, that they are the ones actually who broke Zeus's law. And then in the end, I found it a very strong commentary on religion, and actually a very Christian take on it, not being a Christian myself, but in terms of just that, do unto others as you have done unto you. I thought, I was like, I can't help but look at some of the politics of some of the countries currently and not feel like that can't be applied to them. And it's so, I think it is a story for our time.
Yeah, I think he's quite intentional, and there's some things that make it very, very modern, in there without it being overtly political. Like, a lot of the political stuff came out of the so-called woke casting of this film, which we might get into, because there are actors who are transgender, because there are black actors, I mean Latino actors. Like, oh, they were all Greeks. Well, getting back to that, the British accent idea, how we went through generations of things. There would be French, the Three Musketeers, which is French. How many of them had British accents, or whatever, or Americans doing bad
Or
British?
even the movie Troy, which I enjoyed when it came
Right, yeah.
out. We got
Troy was
Brad
good.
Pitt doing a horrible accent. Diane Kruger is German, and she's playing Helen of Troy. Like, what are we complaining about, people? We're all just telling stories here.
It's I don't know. I just think, again, that to me came from the people that just want to, want to criticize Hollywood just to criticize Hollywood or whatever. But yeah, Tim, what are your thoughts on some of this stuff?
Oh, goodness. There's only one or two things in that diatribe that I would sort of go, yeah, I kind of get what she's talking about. For the most part, I mean, I'm just a huge fan of the movie. I just like so much about it. And we'll get into that. There's just so many things about it that I liked. One of the maybe one of the criticisms. So, for instance, Odysseus. In the original story, he's a much bigger jerk, I think, to start off with, than he was in this movie. Matt Damon, no matter what he does, he's always a little bit likable, and he's like the perfect centrist Hollywood actor. Everybody likes him, and so, like, that the scene where he shoots the arrow into the Cyclops as they're retreating. I was like, that was weird. Why did he do that? Because it didn't seem in character. Like, it didn't seem in character
For Matt
Odysseus, the way
Damon.
Matt Damon was playing him.
Right.
But in the real story, it's perfectly in character because Odysseus is kind of a dick. Like, he's a pompous, lusty, braggadocio. He loves war. He loves killing. He loves conquesting women. He is just that guy. And I think in the real story, he actually beds that witch who turns his men into pigs, right? Like, he actually seduces her, right? I think,
And
in the
I mean
real
that,
story. I can't remember if
yeah,
it's when he's
Cersei.
with Calypso. Well, yeah.
I think so.
Yeah.
But anyway,
Yeah.
so like, that was one
Well, in
thing. Like,
Calypso too, yeah.
when Matt Damon has his sort of awakening moment watching the plunder of Troy, where he's kind of like, oh, this is actually not a great thing. I didn't s ever see the side of him that enjoyed it to make, like, I didn't see the side of him that was getting a rush out of killing these people and defeating the enemies that made that awakening moment what it could have been. Because it kind of felt like, well, of course, Matt Damon is not liking what he's seeing. All these people killing babies and women in the streets. And it was just, there was a lot of him just kind of going, what have we done? But we didn't see the other side of him very much, that very much enjoyed and ordered this kind of orgy of violence, So
And I
in
can't
that
remember.
respect, I kind of see a little bit what she's talking about. It did have some of the, a little bit of the life, maybe a little bit of the range chopped out of it. That is true. There were no sex scenes, and there are sex scenes in the Odyssey, or at least not sex scenes, but there's sex stories, you know. So in some of that, there is some of that, like that just cauldron of passion. A little bit of like the temperature was turned down on it a little bit for the film version. It didn't bubble quite as high. So I get that. So I would say yes, I understand her point there. But Matt Damon's, he did have a journey. He did change. All that woke stuff that you were talking about, Jason, or not woke stuff, you know what I mean? Like the criticisms about woke
Use of
stuff,
it, yeah.
ridiculous. Lupita was magnificent. Elliot was magnificent, especially the last little bit there. The last time he shows up, he was very good. The food looked great to me.
I don't understand the. That's got to be a joke about the food, like
There must be, because that I wanted to eat that cheese in the cave. I would say maybe I see a little bit of what she's talking about, but I don't understand the level of vitriol with which she's writing, because she sounds really angry. And I'm like, I don't get the anger. I don't think it was that bad.
I don't
And
know.
it is an adaptation of.
Well, I
Another thing
mean,
that is quite apparent to me too, it's like he really was leaning on the side of not relying on the gods in terms of narratively or showing them, right? You would have some sound effects from time to time, and even the characters who are, you know, supposed to be demigods or whatnot. There's really not much, like, you know, that's another bit of a turn that I enjoyed anyways, is like, you know, you think you're watching him being guided by Athena, but what you're actually then being was like, oh, this ties into the guild. It's actually not the goddess. He witnessed this young woman meeting her end during the sack of Troy and has linked her to the idea of Athena in terms of the statue, and like that's why the connection's there. So even though who you thought you were watching as a god, as a character, is revealed to not being really the god you thought it was.
Sort of
And
the
the witch
guilt.
character was originally a goddess too, right?
Sorry?
The witch character was originally a goddess too,
See?
wasn't she?
And is it Calypso, who he stays with for 7 years, I think, as I recall, is a demigod or in the story as well. That seduces him and keeps him under her power to stay with her for 7 years.
I didn't realize that until I read it afterwards. Because I went back and was reading up on it, trying to remember who everybody was. I was like, what?
I think, and some of this relates to an interview I heard from him. He was on the Daily Show. Jon Stewart interviewed him. It was a very good interview. And he there was comparison to a lot of his other films in there, but one of the things that got brought up was the idea of the Batman movies. Thinking, you know, I always think of The Dark Knight, but that's the one of the three I've obviously watched the most there. Where he takes the superhero thing, but he grounds it into the reality of a crime story in, you know, Gotham being basically a version of Chicago. Here, instead of relying on the gods, he grounds this into more of an earthly story. But then there's always the risk there that the, you know, the comic book fans will come after you because it's not comic booky enough, when they're used to like different versions of Batman. And of course, then those who are pretty committed to the classics and the importance of the gods, and we would see in those, you know, traditional, like before the technology could kind of catch up to this type of a film, where like the scenes with the gods always reminded me, like we're gonna stop the main story to watch what the gods are talking about, but it'd be in a separate space, and it always looked kind of cheesy, no matter how great the actors were that were kind of in Clash of the Titans or like in Jason and the Argonauts or like those types of films there. I was happy to not really have that, but to have that that feel that, you know, the belief around them is so powerful. And then like these various supernatural encounters, and like I wasn't quite sure how they were going to handle the going into hell, into mm-hmm. the 80s section. I thought that was really well shot and well put together. And it still is kind of like you're on the borderline of, you know, you're on Earth, but then there's like, we're seeing this kind of this, the results of all these dead people here, and that conversation and how all that went. When was originally I thought, where you get some like strange CGI thing where he's like going through, you know, the River Styx, like how was this going to be laid out? And I think he did it, and you know, kind of stuck to, you know, the vision he had for what this piece was going to be.
A week of night shoots in Iceland, that's all you need to do. That's
that what it was.
That's it.
They're in Iceland. Yeah, there's a specific beach in Iceland that has that dark, dark soil. So they went to Iceland and they shot those exteriors, night shoots. Yeah. And all those bodies rising were all stunt performers in the ground with small snorkels, breathing apparatus, so they could all get up out of the sand at the same time. So they would have no footprints on the sand. It would all look like uncovered earth, and they would just all get up. So just, can you imagine, like, who's the first poor bastard who's getting buried alive with a straw? All right, just wait till we say action.
In 3.7 hours after we get all these other guys buried.
Yeah. And we only have 3 minutes to get the shot, because that's how long before we have to reload the IMAX camera.
The IMAX camera, that's the other thing about this. And I mean, you know, how it's shot, and I mean, the editing for the film, again, expert job. And this is the same editor he used Jennifer Lane, I believe, that he used for Oppenheimer as well. That's very difficult. Very difficult. Like, it's almost the thing, and I think I talked about it with the Christopher Nolan episode, that I almost feel like I'm more impressed with like what he does for cinema and the lengths he goes and the filmmaking process and all that, versus overall what I get from it. Like, and I kind of said that to me, and I'm now at a point where the screenplay isn't the most important thing for a Christopher Nolan film, but one of my issues with some of his films, and I have some examples of this here, not totally, but where, again, the star of the movie is Christopher Nolan, and I mean this, he's not the only auteur filmmaker that is like this, but he can have his pick of anybody that he wants in Hollywood. And he gives some people the chance to do what they do well, but then there's other people that are there, but I don't think are ever given their moment. So, you know, you mentioned Athena, like there is nobody hotter right now than Zendaya. Like, Zendaya's in 4 movies this year, has the last season of Euphoria. Is, I mean, I get kind of hyperbolic, because this is one of the young actors that I really think is something special. I don't think you have that one moment, which is like, again, it's in a bit of a montage where we discover, you know, this spoiler for the movie, I guess, that this is, you know, this was this young girl. But that's the closest to an acting moment. Most of the time it's like this, you know, Yoda-like guiding force when, you know, whenever he needs to turn to Athena. And I'm not sure, like, if you have Zendaya in the movie, give Zendaya something more to do. And I mean, particularly with Inception, I was critical of that. I think some other actors are given some really good moments. And certainly the performance I've heard the most buzz around and earned is Samantha Morton, an actor I've loved for years, playing Cersei, that sequence, The Witch, as, because, like, she's given, you know, she seems like this woman alone, and the soldiers come in, and then we see the turn, and she does that so well that, okay, that maybe that role was a little bit juicier, I don't know, but you have all these A-list actors, and some of them are kind of in roles that perhaps anybody could have filled that role, as opposed to, like, giving them something where they can really show what they do. But it almost seems like, again, in his films, it's not always about the emotional payoff. it's about the intellectual payoff. This one mixed it a little bit. I think Matt Damon gets his moments. John Leguizamo, this is his best role in years in a film.
Yeah, he was so good.
Yeah,
He was so good.
There's some Oscar talk already around him. So he gives some people that opportunity, but some other actors who I was kind of excited to see. Elliot Page is quite good and is given, I think, arguably a little bit more to do than in Inception, some years before, and has a moment or two, but it still kind of sits there a bit. I think,
Well, I guess I would counter, Jason, for an almost 3 hour movie, the pie is only so big. And to your
That's
point,
true.
he could have cast other people in those roles, but I think it speaks to, as you said, his draw and that people want to work with him. So people are willing, like, I don't care how big the part is, I'll come and just be a part of it. Like, I know Matt Damon said that about Interstellar. He's like, he was sold on it as being a bit part, but it didn't matter to him because he just wanted to work with him. And then now he's playing Odysseus. So I wouldn't be surprised if Zendaya 3, 5, 6 years down the road is all of a sudden back in a Nolan film and
Is the star, yeah.
playing something much, much bigger.
And the other thing too is that a role is only as small as you make it. Like, there's a lot of actors who have broken out by doing exceptionally well in small roles. And I totally understand. Like, in a lot of scenes, Zendaya is just kind of sitting there nodding wistfully, or looking poignant or whatever. But a really good actor. Like, Cate Blanchett is not on screen very much in Lord of the Rings. She does not have a lot of screen time as Galadriel. But what she does in those moments is unbelievable. It is so unforgettable. And there's ways for good actresses to make small moments memorable.
And I think
I like her. I think she's still maturing as an actor. And I agree with you that the scenes didn't give her tons to do. But it's kind of, there's blame both. Like, it's not all the writing's fault. It's not all the director's fault. As an actor, you got to take what you're given and just do the very best you can and make it memorable.
And
I
this is
guess
where I'll put on my producer hat, and then
yeah.
I'll give you back the mic, Jason. And I'm not saying this to be flippant. I would not be surprised if it's like, these are the days she's available.
Yes. She does four movies this year, so
So it's like, when can you get her? What shots? It's like, yeah, maybe it'd be nice if she's on the boat. We're not putting Zendaya in any of the boat scenes. It will only be when he's on land. And like, it's
that's
like,
fair. That's fair. I
it
mean
might even
that
just
could
be the
be.
logistics of shooting end up playing a part about where someone appears in the movie.
I guess what it is, it's I'm not just talking about this movie, but it's a trend I've noticed where he has A or A plus list actors, and they're sitting there as kind of plot devices more than, fully fleshed out. And I don't think Zendaya is doing anything wrong in the performance. I mean, it's hard to be reacting to the main character and listening, and that's what a lot of the so it's not criticism. I am going to and by means of mentioning another movie this year that I really love, I'm not sure either of you have seen The Drama, which
I haven't yet.
Zendaya and Zendaya is given, and that is the star, is given a lot to do and is very good.
It was Robert
And
Pattinson, right?
Robert Pattinson,
Right.
and I mean, they're in three movies together. Tom Holland, who's in this, they're in three movies together this year. It's kind of a weird, those three actors in so much stuff in the same year, but this is a kind of a way of like getting into Robert Pattinson as an antagonist. I don't want to pronounce it, mispronounce some of the characters' names here, who wants to step in and marry Penelope because it's all these years that Odysseus has been away. I think, he's perhaps a true antagonist of the film. And Robert Pattinson took so many steps forward for me in the drama because he's very, very good in it.
Yeah, he
And
is
now I
good.
feel like we've
Both in the
taken some
drama.
steps back because I thought he was almost asleep in this performance. And he actually is given some opportunities to do some kind of big things. Like, this is the villain in a major film based on a classic work, and he just feels like kind of a bit of a dead zone as a major antagonist in comparison to some of the other secondary characters. I mean, that seem to have some life to them.
I kind of like him.
Time.
Yeah. Honest yeah, with you,
I kind of felt
him.
Like mission accomplished. I thought he read the assignment and did what he needed to do.
Yeah, I thought he was. Sorry, I thought he was pretty good.
But, yeah, and I've been very hard on him as an actor. So maybe just my thing, but yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
I
mean, he has had some outstanding performances over the years, to be sure. But you know, I thought. He was very different in this movie than I've seen him in a lot of other movies. And, yeah, I agree with Sky. I think he understood the assignment and he delivered on it. He was a contemptible man. He was selfish and ruthless. He was fundamentally a coward. He was a lot of things that Robert doesn't often play. I liked it.
No, I just thought like this idea of and like another to me really, you know, up and coming actor Mia Goth, the two of them were conspiring together, and I thought like those two together, like there was the potential for like great villainy, and I never really felt it. Like I never felt him as a threat. I knew what he was doing. I knew you know, kicking the dog, and they're being mean to the blind servant, and like doing all these things. But I didn't feel the threat from him at any moment. And I mean, yeah, like Matt Damon has the nice guy problem. We talked about it in that show, and that, like the reason like Affleck became kind of the villain between in that partnership, and there's nothing, you know, Matt Damon can do wrong, and yet like he. We kind of appreciate the roles where he would play a villain in The Departed or Talented Mr. Ripley here. But like, yeah, you could tell he showed up for work. That you were saying, like some of his roles, you felt that he would sometimes show up and do the demon thing. I think he showed up for work in this.
Yeah, I agree. I think he really showed up for this.
He brought that energy. I just don't think that energy ever matched Pattinson's. Pattinson just seems so much less interesting to me than, but again, yeah. The subjective thing, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely.
He didn't feel like a threat in terms of a face-on confrontation, but he did feel like a threat to me in terms of a stab in the back. Like, I was always thinking at some point he's going to put a spear between Odysseus's shoulder blades, or he's going to find a way to kill his wife, or he's, and you know, there's some way this guy is such a coward and he's so treacherous. He's going to do something really mean and nasty that only a coward would do. So I did feel a threat from him, but not like a man to man, you know, like mono face to face threat. But I did feel that he was a threat in terms of treachery.
Well, I mean, maybe not a fair comparison, but I do think of like if we're looking at Iago and what Kenneth Branagh did in that. I'm not a huge fan of that film version with Lawrence Fishburne, but Kenneth Branagh's performance was amazing. He was such a sleazy, wormy character. And I think, you know, I do get that vibe from this, but there was such energy in that performance. And I just don't see it like quite as much. The other controversial take, you had mentioned Lupita Nyong'o and you thought like outstanding. This is another one where I think, this is like one of the great actors that Nolan has. And again, I never saw, you know, she's there, but I never saw other than like one quick moment where Agamemnon gets murdered, where we saw like this great moment for her as an actor. Like the characters did their things and, you know, move the story along, but I was kind of waiting for a little bit more because that was one of the big names advertised in this ensemble. And I think about, you know, she did in Us, or I mean 12 Years a Slave, given a lot more, you know, screen time in those films for sure. She's capable of elevating any movie that she's in, and here she was along for the ride, kind of. It might be, maybe that sounds harsher than it's should sound, but
Yeah, for me, and I'm repeating myself, I think it is just the nature of that many characters in this biggest story, and what is your priority? Like, if you were telling the story of the Iliad and not the Odyssey, then you might be leaning in to that a bit more. But I also think it's in part by choice, because I know it's only embedded in one line, but for me it was actually a big key to, I think, what Nolan was doing with the whole thing, when they have the scene between Penelope and Odysseus before he leaves, and he's saying how he's going to have to go, and Agamemnon is going to do this, and it's like, well, but he'll move on. It's like, it's actually not about her. It's actually more about he's going to use this as an excuse to break up the trade routes. It's got nothing to do with her, really. That's the excuse to start all of this fighting, which, like, that's the comment, is that's what Nolan's leaning into in this adaptation of it's actually this whole thing. It's not so much
That's one where I
about
was
that.
like, that's one where I was just like, okay, that's a key line for relating it to 2026 and
Sure.
the wars that are happening now. What are they about?
Ostensibly for one reason, but actually for
Yeah, it's
another.
like we're saying it's for this, but it's actually for this other thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I didn't mind that, insofar as that I don't mind the expectation being kind of flipped on its head a little bit. I wasn't expecting it to be a big role already because it was the Odyssey and not the Iliad. I thought it was neat having her play the sisters as twins. I wasn't
Yeah, that
expecting
was
that
good.
either. I'm like, oh,
I mean,
okay,
either.
cool.
She's played twins before, again, us, which
Yeah, that's
is a
right.
great performance. And I think the only reason she wasn't up for an Oscar for that is because it was a horror movie. But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sounding a little bit negative on it. Like, maybe going back to my question about how you feel about, I can, part of it is maybe my, I don't know. I don't know if I'm like a hater or I'm just trying to bring this movie down to earth. It's no doubt it's one of the best movies of the year.
You're adding conflict, Jason. You're doing what every good thespian does. You're adding conflict to what could just be a
A love fest.
sloppy romantic.
A love fest. We could all say, oh,
Yeah.
we love this,
Yeah.
we love that. But all that to say, I mean, I'm sure it's gonna be on my top 10 list, and I'm gonna agree with the majority of it's whatever it happens, if it's like the Oppenheimer idea and it survives through the whole award season and is the top contender. But I don't want to stop the year, because there's a lot of really interesting movies yet to come. And sometimes September to December, and really with limited release, it's realistically till like February here. There's
Right.
such interesting, exciting movies, and we do see some years. That's where I almost thought that was going to happen with Oppenheimer a few years ago, where something all year long, it's about one movie. And
Yeah.
then towards the end of that awards trajectory, and then Nora comes along and, like, steals the day, or a King's Speech, or, like a Birdman, like something like that comes along. And it's just like all year long, the common thought is that this is the movie that's going to be this. This is the Schindler's List of this year, or the Forrest Gump, or something like that. But I'm open to the idea that I'm going to see a better movie in 2026. I also I'm not sure, and in a bit we'll maybe kind of say where we generally feel about this in our rank of Nolan. I'm also not willing to say this is Christopher Nolan's best film.
I
I think
agree.
you could
I
argue
agree.
it's one of his best, and as far as ambition goes, this might be, well, no, I think it is more ambitious than Oppenheimer, which is a pretty ambitious film. So so and
Yeah.
it's, so it's all these things, like the behind the scenes stuff with him and the risks he takes, and the fact he said he had so much, like, this is his blank check movie. He said he needed Oppenheimer and Oppenheimer's success and money to get this one made, because it wouldn't have necessarily, he wouldn't have, even with the Dark Knight and his whole history of like one classic movie after another. I think he's always come in early and under budget or something like that. He still needed the last movie to be able to get this one to happen too, which is an amazing thing to me. But he also had to, like, move over to Universal Studios for a variety of reasons, as opposed to sticking with Warner Brothers, which is,
Why he doesn't work with Hans Zimmer anymore.
yeah. But the people that he got to replace his
Amazing.
killers are amazing. Like, the music, the cinematography, the production design, the costumes, like you name it, it looks great. I mean, this is a A-plus level. But again, if he's now being crowned the greatest living filmmaker, which I know I'm kind of committed to the older guys still. I still can't let my Martin Scorsese's go. Then I think we can be a little bit harder on him because he has his choice of every actor that he wants, and he is given he could go to Iceland to shoot that sequence when other filmmakers are just trying to raise the money to get their story out there, and don't have that kind of idea. So, all
Yeah,
that
I
said,
think I would say that, the degree of difficulty has never been higher on this one. Like,
Yes.
I don't, he's doing things on this or had to do things to make it in the way he wanted to make it that he had never done before. And so I think I would say it's probably his most difficult movie he ever made, by the sounds of it, from what I've heard. But yeah, it's not my favorite. I still have a few of his other earlier films that I say that I love or enjoy more than this one, but I really like this one.
And he's never made life on easy on himself.
Oh.
I mean, no, even I did catch up to, I don't think when I last talked to you, Sky, I hadn't watched Following. And I have seen it since. For kind of like the next step beyond a student film, like a first feature film, that's a very complex movie to make work. So, I mean, he never makes it easy on himself, but he keeps challenging himself. And they, again, he seems like such an intelligent guy too. I mean, it just, again, from how he deconstructs and kind of figures out a way, like, it's amazing that such an intelligent guy could also make what is being considered like high level popcorn movies, because that doesn't always compute. Like, I mean, I'm not sure Kubrick always won over his audiences immediately, even though he was such a cerebral filmmaker who had made such an impact, but things were very divided for him on most of his releases for years. This is a guy who, when his movie comes out, it is an event and people really get behind it. And I can't think of anybody right now in his generation of filmmakers, other than perhaps Quentin Tarantino is the only other person that when he does a movie, it's an event. But that's because Quentin's just set this 10 movie limit on himself and he's
Not
struggling
working
to
as
figure out what
often.
his last project's going to be, right? But yeah. Jim, what do you think?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I haven't read enough about the making of this movie to even know if it's his most ambitious project production-wise. I can see how it could be. Anytime you're shooting on water, you're asking for a colossal headache. Any director who's directed movies that involve watercraft, always talk about regretting it. And yeah, like all the puppetry and just finding clever ways to do things that everyone would do CGI, but without CGI. Is the point we're discussing, are you asking me where I think this ranks? Are we moving into that category or what?
We could move into it here, but it's, just a, yeah, just a question of, yeah, I guess I think part of the reason that, again, hearing about the making of it, and the fact that, like, in the past he did IMAX sequences for action sequences for The Dark Knight, and but he had never done the entire film in IMAX with an IMAX camera that has, whatever it
Yeah,
is, a
no,
battery
that's
life of three
crazy. I know.
minutes
And this
and
IMAX camera, like, it weighs a ton, right? Like, this thing is
No, it's
awesome.
enormous.
That's
Like,
the thing that they did on this is you should go, you'll go down the rabbit hole, Tim. I think you'll love it. Like, the stuff they I
did
have
on
seen a
this, it
little
was
bit. I have
bonkers.
watched some of the making of stuff with the camera, and I like the
Yeah.
work they had to do to make
Like
that thing
to
mobile
silence
for
the
practice
camera, to
shots.
make the blimp, to make it soundproof, to then, like, well, now how do you get the eye lines? Well, now we're gonna have a mirror system so the
Yeah.
actors can act with each other around the camera.
Okay.
Like, stuff like that is just
Sure.
like, oh my God.
But then the point is, before we get to our ranks of it, like, okay, so he's doing that, and I kind of admire it, and he's like, okay, so committed to IMAX. But as Sky said, there's only, like, how many did you say, 11 screens in the world that can
41,
properly,
41 in the
sorry,
world.
41. Yeah, okay,
And
I
did I
am
need to go to one? Like, no, I was happy to watch it in a regular theater, so.
And So that was the only debate. People are loving the movie, but I heard some, like, why would you shoot it that way when most movie theaters in the world, and then once it becomes available for television,
yeah,
it's not going to be able to have that kind of a
without some crazy
screen. Things are going to have to be modified or cut out or whatever of this frame that you shot by doing that. Like, is what's the thought other than like we go to IMAX movies, get out to the movies. He's kind of like the director version of Tom Cruise going around to every summer blockbuster and come out to the movies. And look, yeah, I paid for the entire theater staff to come and sit and watch this, you know, which I like about Tom Cruise right now. And I like about Christopher Nolan, but as far as like the long-term impact on that is, you know,
so this is kind of an example of what you were talking about earlier about the movie starring Christopher Nolan, right? Like the way that he committed to that IMAX camera and the Herculean effort that was made by the production team to facilitate his desire to film this thing with that small automobile sized camera. Yeah. I get what you're saying. Like it is kind of like a, not masturbatory, but a
indulgent,
a little bit indulgent choice. And you know, another thing about this movie, it might have been one of the most traditional movies he's ever done in terms of narrative storytelling. Like, he used flashbacks the way normal people use flashbacks, as opposed to a lot of his earlier movies where time gets so friggin' messed up. Like, even Dunkirk, there were times where I was like, I don't remember.
Yeah.
I don't know right now if I'm in the past or the future or the present. Like, when, you know, I'm like, there were moments in that movie where he was using time in a very non-conventional way.
Yeah.
And this was one of the most conventional movies I've seen of his in terms of like just narrative storytelling,
which might be one of the reasons why so many people are going to it and enjoying it. Like,
yeah,
they don't feel potentially frustrated like so many people were with Tenet or,
yeah,
you know, yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah
they don't have to have a mastery of physics and everything that like the,
yeah,
the dialogue.
I enjoy Tenet more every time I watch it, but it is the kind of thing that demands rewatching.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Or like, again, Interstellar with, you know, black holes and like, just again, his intelligence is off the wall, and
yeah,
he brings that into kind of popcorn movies, and that's something I gotta like about him. Yeah, even
yeah,
though I would give parts of my body to work and direct some of the actors that he gets to work with. Like, I like, oh, let's give you your moment, like, you're like, for lack of a better term, you're for consideration moment. Let's give each of them, like, he really does seem to, he must like Anne Hathaway there, because he gives her maybe some of the best emotional moments of any character he's ever had in any of his films, you know.
All right, Sky, I got a question for you. What did you think about casting Anne Hathaway in that role?
Well, I guess they're Matt Damon's American. American, fine. Zendaya would have been too young, I guess.
Yeah.
Zendaya would have just killed that role. But Hathaway, there's a lot of Oscar talk around her, too, for this. Her and Samantha Morton in maybe the same category. But
I liked it in the end, Tim. I when I saw the cast, I was like, oh, I wonder who she's playing. You know, when they did like a reveal,
yeah,
however many years ago, now two or one or whatever it was, and they kind of put up the cast. But it's like, kind of like when I heard, like, oh, well, that makes sense. They have to jump around time. I'm like, am I going to believe that she's, you know, Tom Holland's mom when we're on camera? Will that work? Right. And it worked fine for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what did you guys think about Tom Holland's performance? I read some rank of the actors and he was ranked like at the back of it, but I thought he was fine. Like, I mean,
I thought he was good. I thought it was like kind of what we were saying about Zendaya. He did his assignment.
Mm-hmm.
He had a lot more opportunity.
He did.
And I didn't think it was his best. You know, I thought he was fairly level throughout.
Mm-hmm. My favorite of his performances is The Impossible when he was a kid. I mean, just
yeah, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was his best work, but I thought he did the job.
I didn't think he was bad, and I thought he looked like he was really happy to be there, and he just seemed to have a certain life to him that Robert Pattinson I didn't see as much in. But maybe it's the light in the dark, and maybe that was the idea behind it. But I didn't think it was a bad performance. And didn't he, like, he had to, because he had the Spider-Man movie, which is coming out at the time we record this next week. There's kind of 2 weeks between these two films. I think he talked to Marvel about pushing the schedule back so that he had this opportunity to be in this film. And he said, you don't get that call from Christopher Nolan. And they listened to him and realized that this is our competition for the summer box office. And somehow kind of made that work, but it really works for him to be in likely what will be two of the biggest money makers of the summer. So
quite something.
Yeah. In the end, though, he was part of the scene where the movie then took the next step for me. Like I said, I was enjoying it, but it was the scene where he realized that this stranger was his dad with the dog. Good. And so that was the scene where I engaged emotionally, like, oh, yeah, there, that hit me right in the heart.
He played that moment well.
That scene was his highlight, and then it made the rest of the movie the emotional journey that I was hoping the movie would give me. It just happened for the last quarter. You know, I needed everything up to that point to give me what I needed in order to then buy in for the last stretch.
And the climax is so well done. I mean, it's an amazing, and the guy knows how to direct an action scene, of course, but it was. The build up to that moment was so strong too,
and we got the Jason Bourne that we were final Jason Bourne movie that we were all hoping for.
One of the things I did see come across my social media feed at some point was like a synopsis of the Odyssey. It's like, okay, Jason Bourne's trying to get back home to Catwoman, but her son Spider-Man, and it's like, but then Batman is trying to get with Catwoman. It was just basically taking everybody's like superhero big marquee movie moniker. I'm like, that was pretty good.
That is pretty good. Yeah. Did you buy that John Leguizamo wouldn't spot immediately that this was Odysseus?
It didn't bug me, but Christy, my wife, you know, I know you both know Christy. Christy's like, come on. That guy who can hear the servant make a noise down the hallway with his loud shoes, and you're going to try to convince me he can't recognize it. I'm like, well, it has been like almost 20 years, but
when I was watching it, I was kind of surprised that the loyal servant doesn't catch on to the master's return. Because it's kind of like that moment in Ben-Hur, right? When Charlton Heston finally returns and the servant recognizes him immediately.
And they kind of have that in this one where, of course, it's based off the scar of his leg when he's getting his feet washed. So you have one servant who kind of pieces it together. But
I did not. It that did strike me as a little troublesome when I watched it a little bit. But, man, Leguizamo is so good.
Yeah, he's – and I think he's always been good, but he's kind of been given like these two-dimensional roles for years. And, like, his one-man shows are just hilarious, but also, you know, satirical, but on point and, like, tell stories. And I've never felt like – I know he did get a nomination many years ago for Tu Wong Fu, but he was either kind of playing a gangster or he was playing a clown in a lot of things. And this gives him some really good things to do. I think initially I was like, okay, let's see how this goes. Let's see if he overplays his hand, but I think it was the right balance where I felt very the emotion of the character. He was given his actory moments, kind of like Anne Hathaway was, or Samantha Morton was, but there were other people that I just thought could have too, but that's not necessarily the reason. It's not my favorite, but it's just because I want to give this one a little bit more time.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I'll start off, I'll say that I think this is probably number four for me. I have to think about where it is with it. It's kind of similar in the same league as Interstellar. I think that's pretty close to a tie for fourth for me. I think we're, you know, in the show, Dunkirk got the most points when we did our traditional show, Sky, and Dunkirk is one that I still go back to and I is impressive, but again, he forces his audience in that movie to pay attention because he only has those little, very subtle title things at the beginning to realize, okay, the one day, 1 hour business of it too. So that's why a lot of people would have gotten confused in Dunkirk and in some of his other movies too, because he forces his audience to pay attention. That's why I agree. This is a little bit, I think even if you went to the bathroom or something like that for a moment, you could still pick up where the story was and not get lost in the Odyssey like you could maybe in some of his other movies or Inception or that. Where would it sit for you, Tim?
Probably four. Yeah, I think probably four for me. Inception for me will always be my favorite Nolan movie. I love Inception to death. I think it's like Nolan loves to mess with time, and that's the script to me where his joy of messing with time served the story the best. Like often he will take a story and he will use time to tell a story a certain way, or with Interstellar, it's very important. But that was the script where messing around with time was critical to the story. And it took, like, Memento for me was a great movie, but not a super accessible movie. And he was able to take the depth. He maybe even went further than he went with Memento in terms of messing with timelines and structure, but the story required it, and it made perfect sense. And you didn't, like, you could watch it. It's flawless. It's almost flawless. So for me, that was my favorite. That's my favorite Nolan movie. And then the first two Batman movies, I loved them. And then, yeah, I would put this ahead of Interstellar for me, but probably fourth for me. And then Memento and one or two others.
Well, for me, I think it was smart that we didn't include Interstellar in our episode because that was just going to be number one for me. It just would have been like for it's, and it was a part about like where I was when I first saw it. Like I was a dad of a young kid at that point, and like there's a
Oh,
dad leaving the kid, right? So it hit me in a way in the movie theater that I wasn't expecting, and I will go back and watch clips of that movie just for the score and like the docking scene alone. Like there are moments from that thing I love it. So yeah, Interstellar is probably still my top, and it'll be hard to knock it off. And then Inception's there, Dunkirk is there. So maybe this is four, maybe five, because then I got a soft spot for Ledger in terms of, Dark Knight. Yeah. So it's up there, but by no means did it kind of topple my top two or three. Yeah.
Yeah, and I know you said, one that
Oh, and I would
love
add
it.
too, The Prestige too is one of
Yeah.
my favorite ones, which we
Oh,
didn't
the
review.
Prestige. I forgot about the Prestige.
And they're doing a 25th anniversary re-release in the new year where that's going to be coming
Cool.
out in theaters, so it's going to get another push. Like
I
that was the
completely
first
forgot
movie
that
I
was a Nolan
watched.
movie.
Yeah, this is the first one I watched in the new theater when it was the brand new theater downtown. That was the first thing I watched in that theater in Saskatoon
I
was the
watched it there
Prestige.
as well. That's where I saw it too, as I recall. Yeah. That's a great one.
So, thank you for doing this. Any kind of final thoughts on the Odyssey or Christopher Nolan, or like your
I
thoughts
think
about
just,
where the place in cinema is right now during this kind of interesting time?
well, because the Oppenheimer comparisons will probably continue because of the time of year in which it came out. And I'm sure you're right, Jason. I'm sure there'll be more things that come out that push the envelope this year. But it's going to be safe to say that it's going to be well recognized by the awards and critics and whatnot, and probably will win a host of technical awards, and then it'll be a matter of like, is this Matt Damon's year? And depending on what are they, Anne Hathaway, is she leading, is she supporting? So that might affect what kind of praise it will get, but it's going to get a lot of praise, and then we'll just see what happens.
I'll throw in, is it Tom Cruise's year?
Yeah, I don't know.
Digger's coming out in
I don't know.
November.
The trailers for Digger don't have me won over yet, but it's just a trailer,
Yeah,
so we'll see.
same. I think I think it's a super solid movie. I don't think it's his best. I'm not certain it's going to be the best movie of the, I think a lot of people are, and it's just typical of humanity in general that when we get excited about something as a species, we go too far. You know, that's just who we are as a species. And I think everyone's really excited about this movie right now. I think it deserves a lot of praise. I think it's a wonderful accomplishment. I think as the year continues, some of that fervor will come down a little bit, and people will sort of will even out in their perception of it, give it its props, give it its flowers, but not deify it. You know, like I think it will come back down into Earth, into our own stratosphere, as the year continues. And I think history will look favorably upon it, but I don't think history will bequeath it, you know, with the kind of garlands that people are giving it right now necessarily. But it's a super solid movie. I hope everyone sees it. It's Matt Damon's fantastic. He's really, really good.
I guess that's the other question. Would this performance subtract your top five Matt Damon list?
Yeah, well, probably would, I think.
Yeah. It wouldn't for me. I would still stick with the list that I had from our show. I think it's an interesting one in there, but I don't. It's funny. I know you don't care for The Martian as much, but I almost this is almost, it's kind of similar to The Martian, where he's in a...
That's the joke, right? Everyone's like, oh, look, Hollywood's spending more money on trying to get Matt Damon home. And like, here we are, like, Saving Private Ryan,
The
Martian, Interstellar. It's like, how many times has this guy got to get home? Just don't let him leave.
Warren's trying to figure out who he is to get home. Yeah.
Buddy.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks so much. I'll mention my usual podcast at the end here, but any stuff that either of you would like to promote out into the internet podcast sphere?
I got a movie premiering at the Cobb International Film Festival in Atlanta in a week or two. It's called Reek. When I say I have a movie, I didn't direct it. I acted in it. But that's kind of my news right now.
Is it Tim Hildebrandt's year for the Oscar?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Matt Damon. That's what I wanted. Let's start that campaign.
So yeah. Anyway, that's going on. That's we got some. It's a short film, but it's a good one. So we're hoping that goes well. And then I'll be back on tour with The Thorn in the Fall.
Cool. And I would just ask people, go see a play. It can be Shakespeare in Saskatchewan. That'd be great. But no, go see a play. There's lots of great theater going on in Saskatoon. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right now, I think you're. Fringe Festival is starting up at the time of recording. This might be a couple episodes or a couple weeks before I get this one out. And certainly we'll be into another exciting theater season coming up soon. And and it's really cool that we caught you, Tim, here while you're here in the home province there. And this kind of worked out that we were all able to see the movie, because I sent the idea out and I thought, okay, just, it might take you quite a while to be able to see this, and I was just like, okay, well, whenever it worked. And then both of you said, well, I actually saw it last night. Well, I watched it twice. Okay, good. Okay, so well, maybe we can do this pretty soon. So, anyway, thanks so much. As I usually do, please check out Larry Parsons' fine podcast, Rank and Review. Still kind of working on, I believe, season 12. Well, it's wrapping up. Sky, I think you'll be on that one in the not too distant future. Mm-hmm. You're kind of the Marvel Universe expert on that podcast there. So, and then please check out Schlock and Awe, Lindsay Wilkins' podcast, and A Lifetime of Hallmark, Kurt Fitzpatrick, Les Kirkendall, Barrett. Again, as I say to everybody, just be kind to one another, be safe, keep supporting the movies, see movies in IMAX or the movie theater, or watch them at home if you want to. And as was said, go to theater as well. I think we may have all had the same professor who lived in London and lived on a diet of something like, I think he went 5 movies and 1 play a week in London. And somebody went and talked to him and said, You need to go see more theater. You need to go to 5 movies and 3 plays a week. That's what you should be doing with your life. So check out theater, check out film, and support artists and support independent podcasts. And until next time, bye.